Hey everybody, this is Derek.
This is Mark.
What up?
What up?
Now we're talking.
Dude, I was thinking about scream therapy, but instead of scream therapy, you just say, what's up, in the most obnoxious way. It's kind of the same thing.
Yeah, that's probably a good idea, actually. Well, that can be your thing. I don't know, patent that.
Yeah, it's like, I'll put it right next to Scream Therapy Centers for Women. It's like the dude version of Scream Therapy.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, trust falls and saying what's up as annoyingly as you can.
Yeah, I'd be down.
Yeah, kind of like...
I watch...
A group of people who probably need to do collective therapy based on how they may have been treated. Okay, I got that. Oh,
oh wow.
Got
you
through
did it, folks. He's talking about the Osage.
Yeah.
I think.
Yeah.
I think. We'll see.
The Osage, dude.
Okay, we're going to talk about Killers of the Flower Moon today. And Twin Peaks. I watched Killers of the Flower Moon, finally. We're not too late. Like, this isn't like Silence where, like, I didn't even know what year it was by the time, like, we were watching the movie. I just realized today, like, Killers of the Flower Moon is nominated for Oscars, like, right now. And the Oscars are this weekend. So this is actually very apropos. Good for us.
Wow.
Yeah.
Somewhat decent timing there for the Brazenheads.
Yeah. It's nominated for 10 Oscars, including like Best Picture, Best Actress. De Niro's up for Best Supporting Actress, or Actor, rather. Lots of stuff. So do you like this movie? What did you think? You want to get into it?
I think it's an interesting story. I guess other people have said this. My wife was saying this. They told it from a perspective. They told it from the least compelling perspective possible.
Mm.
So it's about these white guys who go into this Osage country where they just discovered oil, and Robert De Niro's character King William Hale, William King Hale.
Yeah.
King Hale.
Yep.
He's posing as a philanthropist for the town, but really he's trying to screw all the Indians over because they have head rights on this oil because it's their land. It could have been a cool mystery. I was thinking it could have been like, and there's a lot of subterfuge, and obviously Robert De Niro's the bad guy, and he's manipulating his nephew, who's played by Robert De Niro. By Leonardo DiCaprio.
Mm-hmm.
And so at some point, you know, Leonardo DiCaprio's character isn't as complicit as King Hale's character, as Robert De Niro's character, but at some point he knows what he's doing, and you don't really know what that point is, but that's the least interesting part of it. The more interesting part, I think, would have been from her perspective.
Right.
From Leo's wife's perspective. And I actually saw, I was doing some research today, and I saw interviews of Scorsese saying, you know, we were going to do it from the FBI guy's perspective. But you know, he was doing like the woke thing. Like, we're not going to do it from another white guy's perspective. We're going to do it from the Native American's perspective. It's like, dude, you didn't do that.
Right.
It was from Leo's perspective. It was from the most famous guy's perspective, sort of. You know, but you were kind of dumb like he was.
I was reading the reception section of the Wikipedia page, you know, where they talk about what the critics said about it. And there was some discussion of exactly the same thing that you're talking about. People saying that, like, yeah, it would have been nice to really, like, you know, if the whole point of the story is supposed to be like something that's like enlightening I don't know what you want to call it, like educating a modern audience about this terrible oppression that happened in the past, then they're, probably should have been like a change in the focus of who the story was really revolving around. And it's like, you know, how much can your movie really be teaching this lesson about, oppression. I don't know what other word to use for it. We can talk about the politics of the movie later, but like, if it's still just a movie that stars, Yeah, if it's still just a movie that stars like the two biggest like white male actors in the world and the whole story revolves around their like lives, then maybe it's not really doing what you think it's doing. And I would argue also, especially with the way that it ended, which we can talk about later. Yeah, I get it. I think it's a good observation.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's just not just about teaching oppression, just about teaching compelling stories.
Mm-hmm.
And if you pretty much show me what's going on a third of the way through the movie, I'm not compelled. I care less about this family, this Indian family that's being, you know, taken advantage of. I agree. Except the only thing is, I mean, the whole like, oh, you're telling it from the white guy's perspective because of the famous ones. That's really lame. Like, yeah, why wouldn't you tell it more from a Osage Indian's perspective? That's more respectful. Mm-hmm. You know, I was watching this interview where the guy who wrote the book, he tells the book from the white guy's perspective. I think from the FBI investigators or the federal, it wasn't the FBI at that time, but whatever it was called. He tells the story from his perspective. Mm-hmm. And he got that criticism. He's like, well, aren't you just like whitening this up? And they actually had Molly, I know her first name's Molly in the movie, whoever the Molly in the movie, her granddaughter said, well, you told the story first. I mean, I guess an Indian could have told it, but you told it first, so whatever. And I'm like, yeah. Well, that's a good point.
The first thing that I wrote down in my notes, and we'll go through the movie a little bit systematically here, I think,
well, I hope you don't go through it too systematically, because that's another criticism I have.
Because it's 3.5 hours long, and it's pretty much
just... It did not need to be that. Yeah. Like, dude, this could have been Rosemary's Baby. This could have been Rosemary's Baby in 1910s Oklahoma, and it would have been really cool. But it just kind of stupid. I think, you know what I get the sense is that I think Scorsese thought that like the gravity of the story is enough to carry it, is enough to get you to care. And I'm sorry, it's not. It's just like, yeah, another tale of exploitation, and it's sad. I'm sorry about that, but it's just not for me. Maybe it is for some people, but it's just not for me.
Yeah, and I do think that it's like a powerful story, et cetera, but it just stumbles so badly in certain parts where it's just like the pacing seems completely wrong and it's just weird. Yeah, we'll talk about that. But yeah, the first thing that I wrote down, so the movie begins just to like set the groundwork of what the story is all about by showing a meeting of some Osage elders, presumably. And they're doing a ceremony where they're like burying a sort of like totem and talking about how like, you know, the white man is kind of like impending or pressing in on their culture. And there's like children who are outside of this hut that they're meeting in who are kind of like looking in and over and listening when they shouldn't be to this like private meeting of the council or whatever it is of the adults. But like they know they're there. They even make reference to them in the speech, whatever. And it has this really interesting like kind of shot, just like as a filmmaking technique, where like there's this one moment where you see like the faces of some children like peering in, and it's kind of like juxtaposed where like you're kind of seeing a kid's face, but then like in this other part of the frame, you're seeing like a really zoomed in eyeball. Like you're just seeing like the eye looking in, and it's kind of like jarring, and you know, just makes like a cool visual impact. And then right after that, it shows them like right after they bury this little figurine, it shows them striking oil, and oil erupts out of the ground. And again, there's a really cool shot where like the camera sort of like shakes in this very interesting way. And it's like a very vivid portrayal of like the oil exploding. And then there's this slow-mo footage of Indians dancing in the oil. And it's very like, you know, cool and stylized and whatever. But I wrote down like, you know, it's going to suck if the only thing that I wind up getting out of this movie is just observing these cool filmmaking techniques. You know, if this is just going to be a generic story about how white people ruin indigenous culture, which I agree, like, I'm not trying to, like, have some sort of, like, you know what I mean? I'm not trying to have some sort of, like, reactionary or like pushback against that very generic point. I'm just saying it's kind of boring of a point. And I don't want to just have it be like, well, Scorsese made it and it looks flashy, so like I'm cool with it. Yeah. I want there to be more to it than that, because it's going to be kind of a bummer if I'm spending 3.5 hours just looking at cool shots of a rote story, which in my opinion is like what Wolf of Wall Street was. I mean, I never rewatched Wolf of Wall Street. Maybe there's more to it that I would get on a second viewing, but my first time through, that's exactly what I thought. I was like, okay, this has the fun and the style of like a good Scorsese movie, but I don't care. Like, I don't really give a crap about this. So it's kind of a bummer, especially because it's so long. I don't know if I wound up like sticking with that opinion. I definitely felt that, like, you know, the movie interested me. There's some cool things in it for sure. It's just really like uneven and definitely didn't need to be that long. And there wasn't a lot to it. And I think the perspective criticism is really valid. But for people who don't know anything about it, let's just say the thing that I kind of learned right off the bat and I wasn't really familiar with is like the time and place of the story. This is after World War One, before World War II. The story starts before the Great Depression. DiCaprio's character, Ernest, is returning from the war to his uncle's like family estate in Osage County, his uncle, De Niro, King Hale. And at that time, because oil was discovered on this Indian land and because of the specific way in which the Osage negotiated the treaty, and also because of the specific way in which the federal government wasn't that powerful in this region yet at that time, they were able to cut like a good deal where the Osage retained a ton of the wealth. The Osage wound up being the wealthiest people in the country per capita at that time. They had the most Pierce arrows in a geographic area. Those were like, you know, flashy cars back then.
What does it mean, cool, though, that it's Osage land? I mean, is it what it means now, where it's essentially like socialism on Indian reservations? Like, is it given to the tribal chief and he divvies up the money? Because that's what happens now still.
Yeah, something is going on with the way that the property rights worked there, and I don't think that it was like a developed and firm system back then, because there is some discussion in the movie about how some of the Indians are considered legally like incompetent, meaning that like they have like a white administrator who doles out their money, and we see this happen with Molly.
Well that's just sound business, yeah.
But then there's others who definitely own the land. And there's also some discussion about how like federal jurisdiction might not apply out here, which is like relevant to the tail end of the movie when the law starts getting involved, like you mentioned before. So I guess I don't really know the answer, but that's sort of like the setup.
I just have some questions about that. Cause the Osage are played to be very innocent. And I wonder, I mean, obviously King Hale, I mean, look, But I think it's just more interesting to see two sides of the story, and there's just like one side of the story of these white people going in and victimizing these Indians. It's like, well, there's that issue. Then there's the issue of like this guy, Bill, he marries your sister and then your sister dies and then you marry him.
Mm-hmm.
That's just sounds like one of the strangest things ever. Why not go into that? Like, what's going on there?
We don't really know why that happened. Yeah, we don't really know.
It's like a very strange thing that they just kind of brush over.
Well, I mean, I think this is one of the ways in which the movie is clumsy. I think the reality to that, by the way, this is based on a work of nonfiction, and Molly is a real person, as you mentioned, but I don't know how specific that runs all the way through. Mm-hmm. I don't know if all of these specific marriages and family relations were all reality.
Okay, so maybe that wasn't okay.
I'm not sure, but I think what you're supposed to believe, and they don't do a good enough job of depicting this. I think what you're supposed to believe is that at that time when that happens, King Hale has done such a good job of like duping this community that it would be an honor to be able to marry his son. Like people are looking like you know what I mean? Like he's a very respected and beloved member of the community. At this time, which to us doesn't really, as the viewer, because the way the perspective is, it doesn't really like feel that way. Because even from the first time you meet De Niro, even if you didn't like see any of the marketing for the movie or know the story at all, which I think the marketing kind of gives it away a little, that there's something sinister about this character from what I remember. But also just in the first scene, which, by the way, is my favorite thing in the whole movie, is just the first scene where, you know, Leo comes back and meets with De Niro, the first scene that they have together. I rewatched that today. I think it's just by far the best part of the movie because, you know, it says it all. It's just them meeting for the first time.
None of the Native American characters. That's not your favorite part of the movie. Wow.
Yes. Sorry. I guess I'm a sucker for these, you know, two big name actors. I mean, I am. I'm.
That's one of the things. Your social credit score is going to drop after you have that opinion.
Yeah, I mean, this is one of the things that I was just saying to...
I feel like that's what's going on with this movie a little bit. I know I already kind of made that point, but yeah. It's a social credit movie. I mean, yeah. It's a really sad story, but ultimately it's like these people got flim-flammed. And it's, I don't know, like, yeah, that happens. I'm sorry. And yeah, there was probably some racism. But yeah, it just doesn't... It's not like slavery or something. You know, I mean, I don't know. You can't make another slavery movie. We're all done with those for like another 10 years. I don't know. Just like, and it would have been good. There's enough gravity in the story to make it to craft the plot well, but they didn't do that. Anyway, I'm repeating myself.
Well, I mean, we know from Silence and from several other things. I mean, Goodfellas, Last Temptation of Christ, etc. That Wolf of Wall Street, I guess basically most of his movies. We know this is the thing with Scorsese, is that like he reads a book. It's a book about a drama that happened among people. He gets compelled by it and he determines that it would make a good movie and turns it into a movie. I mean, a lot of his work is that way. This is one of them. And it's a true story. It really happened. It's valid to tell that story. It's obviously culturally apropos. Like you said, it has a social credit cachet to kind of tell a story like this and all that stuff. Like, I get it. And I guess, like, I can't really be too critical about the whitewashing thing because the truth of the matter is I am a complete sucker for Robert De Niro. I just think he's awesome all the time. And he is awesome in this to me. And yeah, like I said, that first scene where they sit down together and he's just kind of like feeling Ernest out and making sure that, you know, he can be trusted and, you know, that he's going to do the right thing in the sense of like, I can mold him into a crook who's going to be a crook in the right way. He's not going to just like get drunk and bring a bunch of heat unnecessarily onto our family. He's going to be able to be like a conniving part of the empire in like that bigger way. And he has a thing in that scene that's so good where he talks about like, you know, don't if you're going to get into trouble, make it big and don't mess with any of that stuff unless you're going for a big score. Like, I don't want you to like get caught out in the open because of liquor or something. You know, he says something like that in a cool old timey way. Mm-hmm. Anyway, so that's kind of like the setup for the whole plot. And then as you mentioned a minute ago, basically what winds up happening is that just as Ernest's brother is already entangled with being married to some of these Indian women, so also Ernest, Leonardo DiCaprio, falls for this Indian woman, Molly, and marries her. And that has the potential to be very good for business, you know, for King Hale, because, you know, if the right pieces fall into place,
King Hale wants him to marry her.
Yeah, right. He kind of suggested in the first place, but this is sort of like the tension in the Ernest character is that he really does love her, though. It's sincere, or as sincere as he can be, you know, as a, you know, criminal, unethical guy. So, yeah.
But see, that's something I think could have been more compelling than it was, is because, yeah, like conceptually, yeah, Ernest is this torn character because he's working for his uncle, but also he really does, in fact, love this woman. But I just don't think that was portrayed very well. Like, the FBI comes to investigate, and Ernest gets all shifty, and that he pretty much seemed totally complicit from then on. So, well, that there was no payoff for it. You know, there's this conflict this guy was going through, and there was nothing. I guess part of the issue is Ernest was supposed to be dumb. I don't know if you got that from watching the movie.
Mm-hmm.
But the idea is he's like, like too stupid. I mean, he's not retarded or anything, but he, you know, he's kind of being taken advantage of by his uncle because he's actually kind of dumb. So
that's a tough one. I don't know. That's a tough one. I mean, does he really come off as dumb in the way that he's supposed to? I'm not really sure. I think it starts off stronger than it ends when it comes to this stuff. I think like the movie does a good job at the beginning of like, you know, as soon as that first De Niro and DiCaprio scene is over, it immediately cuts to this montage showing all of these Indians dying or being killed. And so right away, you know, you're on to the trail of the idea that this, you know, community is being victimized. And you know, we just like smashed from De Niro talking about how like wise and peaceful. And he literally says something like they're the greatest people on God's earth or something like that about the Osage. And then immediately we see them all dying and we know that something sinister is happening. And I think we already know at that point that, you know, we already have an inkling that King Hale is involved. I mean, even just the moment where he tells him to call me King, like you did when you were a kid, like telling somebody to call you King is, you know, and it purposefully, the way that that's acted, it purposefully lingers on the weirdness of that little moment.
Well, too bad Adam McKay didn't take this story because he would have just had some voiceover actress come in and say, King was a really bad guy.
Right.
It'd that be like means a record he's scratch. A douchebag.
Yeah. Well, there are some things that...
Too bad Scorsese just... Yeah, got the script.
Yeah. There is some whack-ass shit like that that is too on the nose, which we'll get to later, I think. But anyway, so yeah, it goes on like this. You know, Ernest and Molly wind up getting married together. The bloodshed continues, and basically all that's happening as the plot moves forward in the first half of this movie is that basically everybody who needs to die in order for everything to be lined up such that King Hale would inherit, you know, the estate, they all die. Like, you know, the dominoes all fall, and yet nobody is any the wiser. There is even a situation
it's just
where
like sets the, I think it's just more. Maybe people know, but they're Indians, so they don't care. Like that one guy who Ernest wanted to get him to kill this Molly's ex-husband or something.
Mm-hmm.
And he wasn't going to do it, but then he found out it was an Indian. He's like, oh, okay. That's right. Different.
Right. Yeah, so
I think it was just the idea of like nobody really cared, and it wasn't until Molly went to Washington and begged them, like, people are dying here, you got to come investigate this. And she gave them a bunch of money, and then finally got people's attention.
Right, and even that was handled, like, that was depicted with some cynicism, that, like, you know, she meets Calvin Coolidge, he doesn't really do anything other than say thank you, but, you know, what really happens is that some money is handed over, and so that's really why the feds get involved. And that whole dynamic is interesting and probably could have been explored a little bit better. Yeah. I mean, first of all, J. Edgar Hoover is mentioned in almost sort of like a comical way, because this is like the beginning of J. Edgar Hoover's career. And, you know, his name comes up and someone's like, I don't know who that is. But also, like, when the feds first show up on Leo's doorstep, it's like, you know, he has no reverence for them at all, which is kind of like, that's kind of a cool little moment that reminds you of like the time and place that you're in, because like now, you know, the feds showing up on your door would be this like very alarming, you know, immediately the stakes would be extremely high. But to him, he's just like, the federal government, like that's way less important to me than like the marshals or the sheriff or, you know, anybody who like I know in my day-to-day life. You're just some fed.
That's what was supposed to come off in that scene?
Yeah, okay. I think there's multiple different times.
I don't know if I read it that way. I just read it as him getting defensive.
Yeah, well, he did that too, but I just think that the overall like attitude that he and others in the movie have about the feds is really like indicative of the fact that like we didn't have as a nation, as a citizens, a concept that like the FBI was this scary centralized thing and the federal government like could, you know, make or break your life. And that's why, you know, this movie is, you know, also at a very simple level, it's really kind of just nothing more than one part Deadwood and one part There Will Be Blood. It does in a certain way feel pretty unnecessary because we kind of like have seen all of this stuff, like the oil side of it, the Indian side of it, the like, you know, freedom loving independence of the frontier versus the encroaching federal government side of it. That's a huge part of Deadwood.
Yeah.
It all does feel like a little bit kind of redundant and unnecessary. I think the one thing about it that is the most interesting and to me just kind of cool was the specific time period that it takes place in. Like there are a couple little small things that I thought were like super interesting. Like for like one that really stuck out to me as a Ken Burns nerd is that there's one scene later on in the movie where everything is getting really hectic and Ernest is starting to freak out that like just there's too many killings, things have gotten too intense, and the town is having like a big festival, kind of like Back to the Future 3. They're having like a hoedown, and he tries to like pull King Hale aside and tell him how concerned he is, and King Hale has to sort of like box his ears and tell him to settle down and like not make a spectacle and whatever. And during that scene, during their hoedown, the song that's playing, this is going deep, but the song that's playing is Livery Stable Blues, which Ken Burns jazz documentary aficionados will know is in many people's analysis basically the first jazz song that was ever published in America. I think he specifically chose that track to evoke this time and place where it's like the onset of like modernism and the jazz age, but it's still in this like country frontier context. Even just the fact they have like cars racing through the street, that was another like very evocative scene. It's like you usually think about like, oh, there's like a whiskey saloon and a guy taking a bath in a barrel, you know, with his legs sticking out or whatever, and there should be like a bunch of horses roped up outside. But in this movie, you're seeing that, and then there's a car driving through there.
Yeah, you get the sense like, yeah, this is a culture I know.
Yeah, and
it's like you see a movie that takes place in 1850, you think, oh, this is different.
Exactly. Yeah, and so there's times when like modernity. you hear like blues songs with like guitars in them instead of just like fiddles and, you know, banjos or whatever you would usually associate with like an Old West setting. Anyway, I just thought that was kind of cool and interesting. It's kind of like the most distinctive thing about the movie to me is to see like those, like the encroaching modernity into this world. And I guess that also
includes... Oh, and the costumes.
Yeah.
Well, I was kidding, but okay, maybe you like the costumes.
Well, I mean, I don't notice costumes, but I thought maybe you observed something about I don't know.
No, I'm just adding some color here.
I'm just yes-anding. but yeah, that like modernity thing, that also applies to the feds too. Like I was saying, it's like this kind of like new thing that is like hitting the scene in this post-war, pre-war, early modern era.
Yeah, and this is like only maybe 40 years before they killed Kennedy.
Right, 50. Exactly.
Right, I mean, doesn't take him long.
Yeah, you hear J. Edgar Hoover's name, and you know, wouldn't you know it? Like this guy is going to be involved in like everything over the course of the next 40 years. The other thing that's, I guess, kind of on a similar note to all of that stuff is the role that insulin plays in this movie. Ernest's wife Molly has diabetes. It's kind of revealed relatively early on in the movie. And at a certain point, through the benevolence and generosity and well-connectedness of King Hale, she's provided with insulin. And they say at the time that this is like ridiculously expensive. It's a brand new drug, and only about 5 people in the country have access to this. So she should be, you know, very thankful. And that, of course, plays a big role as the plot moves forward because I guess we'll get into spoilers here, right? Because we want to talk about the ending.
Yeah, gee, I wonder what happens in this movie where white people are taking advantage of Indians.
Right, exactly. They'll probably win in the end. Yeah, I'm guessing. I think everyone's going to be just fine. So that's another
thing. Did Molly have some kind of, I mean, because she has diabetes and the doctor's telling her to cut back and it's threatening her life and she still must be not eating very well. And yeah, the Native Americans were just more sensitive to sweeter treats, which is why they... would, you know, get obesity and diabetes faster than a white person would get it.
Yeah, I mean, and people to this day say the same thing about alcohol and, Yeah, I don't know. I don't know what to say about that.
Well, I think
that
the alcohol thing is different. Like any population that's been warring a lot in the past 500 years, they don't do very well with alcohol. I think that's more related to that than any kind of like sensitivity or like physiological sensitivity to it.
You think the diabetes thing is like actually genetic inheritable, but the alcoholism thing is not?
Oh, no, I think they're both inheritable. I'm just saying the diabetes thing is more physiological. The alcohol thing is more psychological.
Yeah, I guess I meant like physically.
You know, irritable. Like if you, it's like the Irish or the Scottish, right? I mean, they've just been warring with the English for so long. Anybody who isn't neurotic and crazy and pugnacious, they're dead. Mm. And it's those kinds of traits that would select for something like alcoholism.
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, I guess I don't know.
Same thing with the Native Americans, you know, constantly warring with each other. And I mean, some tribes were peaceful, but a lot weren't. So,
okay, yeah, I guess I don't know. I can see that. I don't know what I think about that, but it's certainly
something to think about. I mean, it's just one of the factors.
And the diabetes thing in this movie is like, you know, they didn't address it. Like, I don't know. They didn't make it crystal clear, but yes, you're right. There's some sort of minor, like there's a couple lines in there that suggest like, you know, she needs to like live better because she's not doing her health any favors. And anyway, they hook her up with this insulin and immediately it becomes a question as to whether this is hurting her or helping her. And yeah, she's just going downhill and really, yeah, you know, I appreciate giving this woman an Oscar nomination. I think the actress's name is Lily Gladstone, if I have that correct. I thought she was great. I'm not taking anything away from her at all. Her face is extremely evocative. And in the few scenes that she has in the beginning of the movie where she actually gets to interact with Leo, she more than holds her own. I think she steals the scenes. I mean, she's fantastic. But 3/4 of the movie is her just laying in a sick bed, like sweating and like feverish. And it's just like, it kind of sucks. Like if she goes on to be the first like native actor to like win an Oscar, cause they're like making a point out of like, you know, I think she's the first native actor to be nominated. It's like arguably kind of stinks that this would be the kind of role that you get that for, because I think there was a lot more that like could have been done with it. But then again, this is a true story. This is what really happened. So I don't know.
Yeah. Anyway. But it's not the most compelling part of the story. And it should have been from her perspective. And it's crazy to me that Scorsese thinks that's what he did.
Right. It's right. Crazy. Especially with the ending, which I'm mad about the very end of the movie. And I want to get to that. So I guess I'll try to get there. Okay. Basically, this insulin thing becomes pivotal in the movie. There's a certain point at which obviously at a certain point it's becoming obvious enough that King Hale is involved in all of this violence. There's some very brutal, like assassinations that happened that I'm kind of glossing over here. But yeah, there's some explosions and some shootings and it gets nasty. Eventually, the feds get involved. It starts to become a real investigation, and the suspicions are lining up against King Hale. And somewhere along the way there, in an effort to try to like secure his advantage and make sure that like the tide doesn't turn against him, King Hale basically gets the crooked doctors in town to like add a sort of supplement to the insulin that Molly is getting injected with. And they instruct Ernest, her husband, like, hey, you have to mix this in with every shot, mix in the whole thing. And it's intimated that like, this is bad for her. Ernest knows that this is bad for her. If he didn't know before, like if he was just kind of ignoring the reality of all the evil that was revolving around him, even as he was involved in it and helping like contract some of these killers.
But what about that scene? Okay, that's what you're supposed to think. But then what about that scene where he dumps it into his drink and drinks it and then he's sick for the next 2 days?
Yeah, well, that's his struggle. I mean, you understand why he did that. That's the struggle. Because he loves her. He's conflicted.
So he doesn't really know for sure. I think that's him really trying to make sure. And maybe that's an indication that I didn't pick up on that he's kind of stupid.
I think that what's happening there, and it's kind of similar to what winds up happening with his testimony, which we'll talk about also, is that when he's in the doctor's office and they're telling him, you know, this is just to slow her down a little bit. You know, this is just to slow her down, which basically means like this is poison. Like, and they really kind of get him like forcefully, like the way that a police interrogator would do. They just kind of like work his will down so that he agrees that, you know, this is for the best and she needs to be slowed down a little bit and just do it. So I think like he knows intellectually, in whatever amount of intellect he has, that it's bad for her in that moment. But then along the way, as time goes on and these things fade, which is like the central theme of this movie, right? King Hale talks about this later on, like all this is going to go away as time goes on. And like maybe this is just like maybe this terrible thing that's happening right now that we're in the middle of is just going to wind up being some common tragedy that fades into the memory and no one's going to give a shit about in the future, which is exactly what happens. It's kind of the point of the whole movie. And in a similar way, I think as time goes on in Ernest's life,
but isn't that just a total paradox? I mean, we're watching a movie about it and it's getting nominated for all these awards. I mean, you can't say nobody cares about it. No, we do care about it. Right.
Yeah.
It just kind of feels like a sappy thing to do. I don't know.
Well, for example, like King Hale gets out of, we find out later that King Hale gets out of prison after bribing the right people and lives out the rest of his life peacefully, you know, surrounded by his loved ones, as the saying goes. So like, it is true that you don't wind up paying the price for this stuff. These tragedies and injustices that you perpetrate on people can be forgotten if you have the right political connections and pull the right strings. I mean, yes, it's good that art can come along later and remind us of the reality of what was done, but in the way that it materially impacted these people's lives, the people who were the most evil in the story wound up being the most okay in the end. And I think that's part of what Scorsese wants us to walk away with.
I guess that's a lot different than people forgetting about it.
Yeah. Well, I mean,
that's two different points. I mean, whether there's justice and whether people forget about it, that's, seem pretty orthogonal to me, Derek.
Well, justice would have been for people to remember what King Hale had done in his lifetime and to have ostracized him. So, like, in that sense, I think that's how they're related. Like, you want to think, oh, this guy went to jail forever, or, you know, he was ostracized or whatever. But that's not what happened, which I think, like, means that he was right when in that jail scene he said, like, you know, people are going to forget about this. It's going to be fine.
Yeah. I mean, look, I get it. I get it. I mean, my issue is, I guess it's the cultural climate that we're in, which is criticizing Western civilization in general. And I think people take stories like this. I'm not saying you're doing this, but I think the zeitgeist is to take stories like this and say, oh, it would have been better if white people didn't come to America, something like that. Like, this is indicative of a sickness in Western culture, which is propagated mainly by white people.
Well, I think you can say that this movie isn't, maybe people do think that, but I think you can't really blame the movie for that. I mean, I think the movie isn't saying anything stronger than just, hey, it would have been nice if this guy who presented himself as a, you know, peace-loving, respectful philanthropist actually was one instead of being like, you know, a deceitful crook.
Did you see Avatar 2, the Way of Water?
No. Is it good?
Oh, dude, you got to watch that movie.
Yeah, I should.
You got to watch that movie and tell me how far you get into it. I mean, well, the most compelling thing to me, did you see the first Avatar?
Yeah, I like the first Avatar.
The most compelling thing to me about it, watching this really jumped out when I was watching the second one, not a little bit while I was watching the first one. It was how easy it would be to rewrite this story where the Na'vi are the bad guys.
Hmm.
Dude, they don't even have books. I mean, that story writes itself.
Well, I guess I have to see it.
And yeah, I mean, there's this very terrible characterization of quote unquote capitalism, but I don't think that's a good basis to judge the conflict between the two civilizations. It's like looking at anti-Jewish Nazi propaganda that says, well, I mean, the Nazis have a point because the Jews are dirty and they are really greedy money grubbers, right? I mean, it's portrayed right there in the movie. I think that's the same way I see the idea of making a profit per trade in Avatar. I wouldn't say capitalism. It's just the idea of making a profit per trade.
I'll have to watch it. I will watch it one of these days for sure. I mean, I'm intuiting that I'm going to like it. I mean, I liked the first one, although, I mean, I don't know. It is James Cameron. He's got a good track record.
Dude, James Cameron can tell a story. And because it was James Cameron, I was telling my wife, like, you know, anybody else, I probably would not still be watching this. But because it's James Cameron, I am. But even then, I still didn't make it through the entire movie.
It's long, right?
It's long, but it just gets really dumb. It feels like a propaganda film.
Speaking of long movies that get really dumb, let me try to get us to the ending in this movie. I think the main points that I wanted to make were, first of all, the insulin is going to wind up being really important. You, the viewer, are kind of watching all along and seeing, like, okay, this guy is poisoning his own wife. To what extent does he know that he's doing it? And like I said a minute ago, I think you wind up being convinced that he knows intellectually that that's what he's doing, but he allows these walls of denial and just avoidance to be built up over time, such that he's capable of having the cognitive dissonance of loving his wife and yet poisoning her. That's like a tragedy that you're seeing portrayed, and it culminates in this one scene which you touched on a minute ago, where he actually like takes half of the poison. And it's like in that moment, it's like my personal read on that is that, again, I think in his brain, he does already know that it's poison, but he's told himself some sort of, you know, coping story about how it's like for the best or whatever. And he just feels this emotional compulsion to subject himself to this thing, you know, because he's seeing his wife suffer and he's just like, okay, what is this? Like, I need to really know what this is. You can read it like, I think what you're kind of saying, you could read it as like, maybe he really didn't think it was poison, and this is the first time he's really thinking to just like try it out and see. Maybe I kind of read it a little bit more, I guess you could say, like, charitably to the character than that.
Yeah, I could see it either way, I guess. That's an interesting take. I mean, I would like to watch this movie again. I think I probably will one day, but give me a little bit. I got to watch some Fast Five to to cleanse the palate.
Right. And by the way, I'm not saying that this movie feels insanely slow. For being a 3.5 hour long movie, it does go along at a decent clip. It's just that it's really uneven and kind of stupid at parts, where it's like you're not bored, you're just thinking like, man, come on, do better, like do this better. So I don't know, there's like a shade of difference there, and that especially to me becomes true at the end of the movie when the law rains down. You know, Ernest winds up getting arrested because some of the people he's contracted into some of these killings basically squeal. And it just goes back and forth in this really ponderous and kind of meandering way, where it's like he gets arrested. They try to interrogate him. He doesn't want to say anything. Then he decides he will say something because it'll help his wife, even if it means betraying his uncle. But then, like, they pull some legal shenanigans, and because King Hale has all of this influence, he kind of orchestrates things so that Ernest has to meet up with King Hale's lawyer and kind of hear the family side of the story, and they sort of convince him to swing back the other way and, like, don't blow this for the whole family, don't betray them, you have to recant your testimony against King Hale. And then it kind of swings back the other way again, where he does point the finger at him, and it just kind of all, it's like much ado about nothing.
Streamline this, make it simple.
Yes, it needed streamlining. His one of his kids dies in the middle of that, which is, you know, like terrible and painful. It's like an emotional scene, but it also is just like, at this point, like, I don't know. It's kind of hard to say, like, who cares? Like, what does that mean at this point?
Isn't that what got him to confront his uncle and turn him in and testify against him?
Yeah, I think that's right. I think it was, like, the one last thing that needed to happen in order to swing him back, you know, after, you know, he's doing the John Kerry, you know, at this point. But he needed to, like, be turned back against King Hale a second time. And that's kind of what convinced him to do it. They have a good scene together, De Niro and DiCaprio at the end.
Is he flip-flopping?
Where he's, yeah, exactly.
Flip-flop.
He's flip-flopping.
Oh, dude. And, dude, yeah, we might have been do that impression a lot that year, 2003.
Oh yeah, oh yeah.
Flip flap. I mean, it's fun to do anyway.
So basically, while this is all going on and Ernest is in lockup, you know, waiting for the legal proceedings, the feds intercede with Molly, the sick wife, in bed and get her off the poison insulin, get her on the good stuff, and she makes a recovery. And there's kind of a climactic, you know, scene. It's the last scene that we get between Ernest and Molly, you know, where he basically tries to say, like, you know, now that I've testified against King Hale, like, I feel good having my conscience unburdened with all of this terrible stuff that I've done. Like, now it's all out in the open, blah, blah, blah. And she just kind of asks him, you know, like, what about the injections you were giving me? And, you know, he's still either in real denial within himself, or he knows the truth and he's lying to her. Again, very similar to when he drinks the poison. It's like, I don't know what his real internal mental state there is. I just think he can't bring himself to admit that one last thing to her, even though he knows. And so he just says that it was insulin. What do you mean? I don't know what you're talking about.
On some level, he knows, but yeah, we don't know what level that is.
So yeah, it's a very poignant, you know, and obviously, like, the way that you do that, imagine you're the screenwriter, you know how to handle that, that she is disgusted with him in that moment. And that's it. That's how she knows it's over. She gets up and walks out on him. And then the thing that really pissed me off, I don't know if you agree with this. I fucking hated that, like, radio stage play ending that they did on the movie. Do you have a take on that?
I didn't hate it. I just thought it was weird and it didn't fit. And it would have made more sense to do something like that if you structured this movie like a true crime podcast series, but you didn't.
Yes, exactly right. I fully agree with that. I think if there had been anything like that earlier in the movie, I mean, yeah, there's this newsreel stuff, which happens once or twice, but there really is nothing else like this in the movie. And to me, it's just totally like getting hit in the face with a cold fish or something. It's just like, I've been here committed to this movie for 3.5 fucking hours, and you're doing like the Moth Radio Hour podcast or whatever to, like, end it, whatever the name of that thing is, I can't remember. But, like, but basically what happens at the end of this movie is, again, to drive home the point that this is like modernism and, like, you know, the modern world is encroaching upon us. Instead of giving, like, a regular, like, postscript to the movie where you, like, conclude everybody's stories, it goes to this, like, meta thing where it's like years later, over the radio, they're doing like a stage performance of like a storytelling hour, you know, like with sound effects and stuff, like how Orson Welles used to do, like, you know, radio theater, the Mercury Theater.
Yeah, it feels very Orson Wellesy.
Yeah, it's one of those things. And they're telling the story of, and it's basically, like you said, it's basically like a 1940s version of a true crime podcast, because they're literally just like telling the story of what happened. They tell you that, you know, King Hale did wind up getting convicted and locked up. He was released in 47, intimated that maybe it was because of some bribes that he paid. Ernest was also sentenced to life in prison, even though he did cooperate with the feds and testify. So he still got screwed by the feds, just like they said he would. But he did eventually get pardoned. He lived out his days with his brother back in Osage County. Molly remarried to a different person and wound up dying of diabetes at age 50. And that's the end. And Scorsese himself comes out in a character as a stage performer this radio show and reads her obituary and just mentions that in her obituary there was no mention of the murders. And that's it. I mean, I think I guess the point of that ending is to sort of drive home again that same old theme that, like, you know, this terrible thing that happened just winds up in the passage of time being another common tragedy. That's the phrase that King Hale uses at one point. But to me, it just felt like a cheap, unsatisfying way of just buttoning everything up. And you kind of had to do it because what else were you going to do? You know, if this is what wound up happening, they go to jail, they get out, she remarries and dies early. Like, what is there to say? It's just the harsh reality of the fact that that's it. That's the end of the Osage oil boom, I guess.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I'm telling you, you need to think that this kind of like white people come in and mess up things for minorities, this kind of narrative is the most important thing to carry the story. That I can't imagine why else it would be this bad. You know, it's the same thing like Don't Look Up. Why would you make such a terrible movie? Oh, because you think global warming's the biggest deal in the world. So you're kind of blind to how terrible this movie is. I think you're blind to the Ariana Grande girl boss scene and how awful that all is. Right? I think it's the same thing with this. I'm guessing, you know, I don't know for sure, but I was trying to do some preparation because it's been a few weeks since I seen the movie and I was just watching some interviews and this was the thrust. I mean, this was the theme of them talking about it.
Mm-hmm.
So
I think I agree with you, and I guess I'm just describing it in a different way. I guess this is a matter of my personal taste, and I wind up coming to the same conclusion as you, but I think it's because of this. It's like, I can respect a movie for being super grandiose and thinking that some specific thing is the most important thing in the world and blowing it up into this like epic tragedy, like a test of endurance, you know, of an emotional film. In fact, I would say that about Silence. You know, like if you're Scorsese, Silence is immensely important to you because it's just like dealing with these fundamental questions of like the way that, you know, a Western meme form of religious faith collides with like a Eastern culture, and just like, you know, what's actually true all the way deep down about the ethics of Christianity when it collides with this thing that is completely different than the context from which it arose. Super interesting, you know, like definitely like arcane, definitely stuff that like a lot of people are just not going to be tuned into. But like, I respect the fact that it'll, you know, go really hardcore in order to explore this super complicated and grandiose thing. And also, I can totally respect a movie that keeps it super small and just is not embarrassed about keeping it super small. And Scorsese does this too. A movie like Mean Streets is just like minuscule. It takes place within like two blocks of like Little Italy with like, you know, three scumbags whose lives don't matter for anything. It just there's nothing to it. But when you're watching it, it's totally compelling. And I can also respect a movie where the point of the movie is just that, like, this bad stuff that you just saw portrayed, there's no answer to it. It just is, and it keeps going, and sorry, that's the harsh reality. I think that's what's great about No Country for Old Men. I mean, the No Country for Old Men is so impactful at the end when you see, like, Anton Chigurh in this, like, suburban neighborhood with his broken arm or whatever, and he just gets into a car accident and then gets away, and he's going to just keep being him. Like that's going to perpetuate itself throughout the world, and Tommy Lee Jones knows it. That's how it is. I can respect all of that stuff. The thing about this is that it's like, it's none of those things. It doesn't hit any of those quadrants. It's sitting in this unsatisfying middle ground where it's like trying to make the super grandiose point. It's dealing with this issue of, you know, whatever you would call it, you know, imperialism, cultural conflict. I don't know what to call it. You know, colonialism isn't the right word for, I guess, capitalism encroaching on native lands. I don't know. But you know what I mean? Like it's dealing with corruption and all this stuff. And it's making that No Country for Old Men point that like, you don't solve this. It just kind of is in the system and it gets digested in the system and however it does and people's lives live out and everybody moves on. It's well, like
kind of the point of Blood Meridian too.
Yeah, you're right. Although Blood Meridian to me feels like cosmic and archetypal. Like it has this magic transcendence to it. Like the judge is something beyond, but King Hale is just like, you know, I don't know, the equivalent of like a Jeffrey Epstein type person. He's just some banal, you know, functionary empire building, like evil guy.
Some mystique to the judge is what you're saying, but to King Hale, you're just like, well,
exactly.
Yeah, you're just, exactly.
That's what I'm trying to say. This movie is, it's missing mystique. It does not have mystique. That's what it is.
Yeah.
Especially when you wind up just showing us like a stage version of a podcast at the end of the movie.
Yeah, you know? Dude, Rosemary's Baby, man. Like that movie haunts your dreams and there's nothing even remotely, you know, it's scary in the typical sense. It's just a compelling story with a mystery.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just very good. And I think you could have done the same thing here, you know, like... like a woman's health, right? Like this potential threat out there affecting women's health. I mean, it's the same thing here. These four daughters are dying.
Mm-hmm.
And, oh, well.
Yeah.
Dude, I really care about Rosemary. Like, I'm thinking about that for weeks on end. And this is a more important story, obviously, because this is real. And mm-hmm. I don't care about it.
Yeah.
That's really sad.
I gotta watch that again. One final note for movie nerds. The guy who plays, he's just like a relatively random guy in the movie. He's one of the murderers. His name in the movie is Kelsey. He's the guy who has like the really sharp, like jawline, like really squared off jawline. I don't know if he made an impression on you, but that guy was in The Irishman, and just the way that he looks and the way that he acts, that's like one of my new favorite little character actors. So keep an eye out for him. If you ever watch The Irishman, he's Sally Bugs, who's a real person, who was a real person in the mob back then. He's one of the drivers in Hoffa's, you know, last drive. But I just, he stuck in my head so hard, just like the way he looked, the way he acted, just like
Kelsey one of those people Morrison. Who makes,
yeah, that's the character's name, I guess. Yeah, the actor's name is something Sensormi. Or cancel me. Yeah, because I remembered it was funny because his last name is like cancel me. But anyway, I just keep an eye out for that actor. I think he's you're going to see him more because he's got one of those actor looks to me where you just remember him when you see him in a movie.
He kind of looks like DDL. I mean, DDL's more handsome, but
yeah, I can picture that. Yeah, like kind of an Italian version of it. Yeah.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Oh, a handsome Italian guy. That's weird. You don't come across those too often. Oh.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, well. I guess it happens. All right. Now on to the real, what we really came to talk about. Twin Peaks 18 masked ball. Dude, where's the masked ball in this episode?
Yeah, what is that? That's a good point.
Well, I think it's different people wearing different masks, not being themselves. Dennis being Denise. Nadine thinking there's that she's in high school.
Yeah, there's the wedding also. Like, maybe that's like a ball. There's dancing.
That's a ball. Pete seems to be very annoyed at the wedding for some reason. I don't understand why, but he's kind of wearing a mask, I guess you could say, a persona. In that situation to keep from, I don't know, going off and being really angry at people.
Yeah, what is the deal with that? When did I forget about what's
happening? I don't know. He's just annoyed for some reason. Maybe like the other scene that references that was cut. Who knows?
Yeah, that's a good...
That's kind of what it feels like.
That is often the kind of thing that happens. Okay, yeah, this is the one where I was accidentally one episode ahead and I already read this Log Lady intro. I'm going to do it again because that was weeks ago. Is life like a game of chess? Are our present moves important for future success? I think so. We paint our future with every present brushstroke. Painting, colors, shapes, textures, composition, repetition of shapes, contrasts. Let nature guide us. Nature is the great teacher. Who is the principal? Sometimes jokes are welcome, like the one about the kid who said, I enjoyed school. It was just the principle of the thing. Good one, Log Lady.
It almost, it's like as you're reading that, it seems like what Andy's doing in this episode is really genuinely trying to be a better person, making choices that are going to affect his future. Or as opposed to Dick, I mean, he's just hanging out with his little brother Nikki to, you know, to win Lucy over. He doesn't really do it because he cares.
True.
And he cares, and that's why he's dancing with Denise.
Yeah.
Who isn't trans, I guess. She's just a transvestite.
Yeah, I mean, that's an interesting question. And
who isn't one of those? I mean, come on.
It comes back up in The Return as well. Yeah, I don't know the right way to address Denise's identity. But I do know that I was Well, yeah, we'll get there later. We'll get there. I'll talk about Denise and The Return when we get there, which I'm excited for. But in this episode, which I'm not excited about at all. Yeah, we're about to set off on a journey here. James is riding his motorcycle to some roadhouse music. And I don't mean like the good roadhouse music from season three. I mean like some cheesy, like
it almost sounds like rockabilly.
Yeah, it's like James is leaving Twin Peaks and entering the world of TV cheese that Twin Peaks is like supposed to be above, and it's kind of what the Twin Perfect video is.
Hey, I don't know if you noticed, but James's brow is furrowed when he was
yeah. Yeah, he's contemplative.
Yeah, it was really surprising that he would have a furrowed brow in that scene with that music
playing. Yeah, you know, he comes off like a bad boy, but actually, like, he's kind of sensitive and intelligent. And there's a lot going on upstairs. It's complicated.
Yeah, yeah, he's a complicated guy.
So, yeah,
acted very well by James.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
He was such a bad actor, they just had to keep his name the same.
that's always a good call.
Because it was like calling Homer Mr. Thompson.
Right.
Now, when I stomp on your foot...
All right,
that's so why I imagine they must have done. I mean,
right.
Speaking of people, yeah, Leo doesn't come off as stupid. They should have gotten James to play Ernest.
Yeah,
it would have totally worked. I mean, it would have been.
Yeah, you're right. I thought you were talking about Leo from Twin Peaks, but yeah, no, Leonardo DiCaprio in Killers of the Flower Moon. Yeah, it's hard to say how stupid he really is, and he doesn't really.
So many Leos.
That's not how we think of him nowadays. Even though he was in What's Eating Gilbert Grape, we don't think about him that way anymore.
Yeah, but I was just talking with my wife about that. That didn't work because he's like a handsome young kid. I mean, he's, you know, I don't want to be like a weird pedophile about this, but is he 12 or 13? You can clearly tell he's going to be a handsome kid.
Yeah, he's a future heartthrob. Yeah.
He doesn't look like a retard. Sorry.
Yeah. I guess not. Good movie, though. Oh, from what I remember it being a good movie. I remember it like bumming me out when I was a kid, but thinking that it was good.
Hmm. Yeah.
Okay, so...
No point about that.
We're going to skim through this Twin Peaks episode. What do we got here? So the important thing that we got plot-wise is that Major Briggs has disappeared. They meet up with Mrs. Briggs to talk about it. And, you know, I think it's kind of cool the way that it's portrayed, how like, look, she's used to this. Major Briggs has been doing insane shit that he can't talk about, dealing with, you know, crazy stuff like, you know, signals from aliens, for a really long time. And she has an ability to kind of understand and, keep her cool, in the face of the situation like that. Not that she's not concerned for her husband, but like, you know, she does have an understanding and a sort of equanimity about like, you know, he's dealing with stuff that we don't understand. She says the fact that you were in the woods is very significant. He talks about the woods constantly.
Man, what a cool wife.
Yeah.
Guys will just go off for a few days, be like, oh, he's just probably working.
Yeah. Well, she is very cool. I think that comes up multiple times, that like, yeah, that, there's something about them and the fact that Bobby is their son. It's just, I don't know. They're interesting. Obviously Major Briggs is a fan favorite. Well, there'll be more Briggs stuff in The Return as well. Even though the actor is no longer with us, unfortunately. Okay. Gordon Cole calls in. You might recall that Coop is being investigated for, you know, going outside of his jurisdiction and messing up the Canadian authorities who were investigating One-Eyed Jack's. They took away Coop's badge, and they'll be sending in Dennis Bryson to help investigate. And again, Coop is, you know, handling it as best he can.
Dead naming somebody already. We're not even 3 minutes into the episode.
Yeah, Lynch is being very problematic, and he'll have to make up for that. In The Return, he tells Coop, a word of advice, let a smile be your umbrella. And then Coop has to meet with Roger, the Fed who's investigating him, and he plays it very cool and kind of indicates.
Too serene.
Yeah, he's very at peace with all of this hubbub about potentially like losing his badge and stuff. He says, I know the moves I'm supposed to make, and I know the board. You know, we have Wyndham Earle playing chess here coming up soon. I've mm-hmm. started to focus out beyond the edge of the board at a bigger game. The sound the wind makes through the pines, the sentience of animals, what we fear in the dark, and what lies beyond the darkness. Pretty cool. Coop is doing
that's just
his...
good writing.
Yeah.
I mean, I think these episodes are really good.
Well, there's good things
in
them.
I mean that. I mean, I think it's like getting compelling in its own way. I mean, we're going to get to it, but Hawk's going to talk about the White and Black Lodge. And like, you got to face your antithesis in the Black Lodge, dude. And unless you do that with perfect courage, you're not going to get to the White Lodge. I mean, this is great stuff.
Yep. That is extremely cool.
See, this is important to me. This is my Killers of the Flower Moon.
Yeah, that stuff is extremely cool, and we are getting there, and it's what keeps season two going, because there's something that keeps it going even when there's stupid shit, like the next scene that shows Nadine and Donna in the hallways at high school, and Nadine talking about how she has a crush on Mike because he has great buns.
Don't you get it? It's a metaphor. You don't. It's adding layers and context to everything happening in this episode. Oh, Philistine.
Yeah. Okay, I'm going fast here. James stops off at a bar called Wally's Hideout and meets a woman named Evelyn. She has her own theme music, which we will be hearing multiple times over the course of the next few episodes. And she asks him to come back to her house and help fix her husband's Jaguar before he gets home and sees the damage that's been done to it. And first, he's got to play a tune on the box. And he fires up the jukebox and that completely weird, like, organ wailing music that they've used before kicks in. So, yeah, good stuff.
Yeah, a lot of awesome subtext in the dialogue.
Yeah, Evelyn is extremely horny. That's the subtext. That is the text.
Okay, we couldn't get Christy Brinkley, so we'll get some chick who kind of looks like her.
Right.
That's what they're thinking. Anyway.
Andy and Richard Tremaine take out little Nikki, their little brother, for an ice cream, and hilarity ensues. Andy says Uncle Dick went funny boom boom or something like that. Or Dick says that. I can't remember.
It's like Dick, they don't understand that the kid's nine, not
right.
18 months.
Right.
Well, yeah. It's a kid. That's stuff you say to a kid.
Yeah.
Good slapstick in here from Andy. Haven't had that in a while.
It's good stuff. Okay, you already mentioned the Hawk thing, which is great. That happens in this episode. You know, right before Briggs disappeared, he asked Cooper, do you know about the White Lodge, or have you ever heard of the White Lodge? And so Coop is following up on that and asks Truman and Hawk about it. And Hawk says that it's something that his people believe in, and that, yeah, every spirit must pass through the Black Lodge. You meet your shadow self. And, you know, if you don't have perfect courage, then you can't pass through the lodge and into the White Lodge, attaining perfection.
Now, this to me is cooler than the murder.
Yeah.
I'm glad there was the murder. I'm glad there was a cool resolution to that just opened up more questions. Now let's get into the good stuff. And Dave Lynch is just being a little brat about it.
Right. Yeah, I mean, by the time you get to, well, whatever. I just keep thinking about the return. I mean, yeah. Laura's story is one instance of a grand cosmic pattern that is playing out, presumably, you know, billions of times across the entire universe, you know, by the time you get to season three of Twin Peaks. And, you know, starting to build up some mythology about the Black Lodge and the White Lodge is our entry into that vastness, which is what makes season three so cool. One of the many things that makes season three so cool. And yeah, the end of season two does give us some of that, which is great. Okay, we meet Dennis Bryson, the agent who was supposed to come investigate Cooper. Turns out it's Denise, played by David Duchovny in woman's clothes.
Yep.
More on that later.
It's just incredible how David Duchovny is not like a macho guy, but you can just tell the way he's walking in the dress, it's not a chick, you know?
It's very just like interesting. That's
something that you can't. Yeah.
Yeah. It's not my area of expertise, but it is very interesting to try to analyze exactly how this was supposed to be played. You have to presume, especially in 1991, that some significant portion of the audience is going to laugh when they see Denise, especially because it's been set up intentionally as this gotcha where, you know, Coop already knows Dennis from his past career and was expecting Dennis based on the name that was given to him over the phone and everything. So it's like, it's kind of like a joke, but of course, you know, to some extent back in 1991, I think people knew they shouldn't laugh about this stuff. And especially nowadays, people are much, much more, cognizant.
Everybody, unconsciously, everybody knows it's funny.
But there is...
A guy in a dress is funny.
Exactly. I mean, and this transcends cultures. You know, the Osage would find this funny also. And in fact, this is part of ritual in all sorts of, you know, different anthropological contexts is, you know, gender bending and stuff like that. So, yeah, it's a whole rat's nest of its own, which, you know, me as a completely boring, vanilla, straight white male, I don't have a ton to say about it. But, you know, so is David Lynch. So is David Duchovny. So, you know, I don't know. It's just, it's something. I will say this, through my various online chat rooms and streams and, Twitch channels that I'm fans of, I know online a fair number of trans people, and to a person, they all love season 3 of Twin Peaks. I mean, everybody loves season 3 of Twin Peaks, and they specifically love Denise, and the way that Gordon and Denise interact in season 3 of Twin Peaks. So I don't think that any faux pas or problematic shit has happened in the end. I think it all comes out good.
So. I'm sure Derek comes across a lot of trans people in the groups that he's in.
I mean, online, in the world of gamers and stuff like that, like, yes, absolutely. It's quite often.
A couple minutes ago, you said you were a straight white male?
Mm-hmm.
Straight, huh? Yeah, I have to change some information on my Rolodex over here.
Well, I'm just, you know, just telling it like it is.
Yeah, I'm really straight, too. I'm super straight.
Well, this is all just padding for the most important scene in the history of Twin Peaks, which is Nadine working out in the weight room next to Mike and impressing him on the leg press machine. Well, good stuff.
Okay, so you think a scene that has Nautilus machines in it, classic Nautilus machines, you don't think that's important? Okay. I guess we just have different values. That's okay.
Yeah. Okay, I said I was going to breeze through this. I haven't really done that. A bunch of Josie stuff happens.
I'm not
helping
out, by the way.
A bunch of pointless Josie stuff happens. Josie finally tells her whole story. Harry just kind of says, like, okay, lay it on me. So she talks about how, like, yeah, when she was back in Hong Kong, she worked for this guy, Thomas Eckerd. He, like, saved me from the streets. I was, like, a lowly waif, and I was lucky that he looked after me. But also he, like, you know, pressured me into things that I was uncomfortable with. And I met this other guy, Andrew Packard. He was, Thomas Eckert's business partner. And then I wound up marrying Andrew, and it was drama with Thomas Eckerd. And then this guy, Mr. Lee, who was in town before, actually is somebody who works for Eckerd and is trying to get me to go back to Hong Kong. It's like, it's this whole thing.
I'm not helping you make this go any faster, and you're definitely not helping yourself.
Yeah, I mean, this is the thing. It's like, when you're watching this... Why would you go into all that? Well, when you're watching this, you are
already
thinking,
annoyed at this episode.
Yeah. Well, it's just like with the mill. It's like when you were trying to keep track of the ledgers at the mill and stuff, you're thinking, this must matter, right? It has to. And then, you know, sure enough, like, none of this is going to matter. But it's going to take up a lot of screen time, that's for sure.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. The last thing I guess worth mentioning is that, well, okay, the Wyndham Earl thing. So Coop gets a note from Wyndham Earl. It contains a tape and it contains a chess move. It says something along the lines of the king must die. And I looked back on this. I went back in my notes. And as far as I can tell, the first chess move that Wyndham Earl ever made was 5 episodes ago. it just goes to show you how weirdly paced out season two of Twin Peaks is. It's like for five episodes, we've been like kind of occasionally hearing about Wyndham Earl, and you think that it's this big giant deal where he's like publishing these chess moves, but like still none of it has really come to anything yet, but it will later.
Yeah.
It's kind of clumsy in my opinion.
Good thing that the casting for Wyndham Earl was perfectly done and they didn't just get some goofy guy.
Yeah, not like a community theater weirdo. Yeah
right. So, so it really... Dude, you're missing the scene. I think that's kind of important where Ben reminisces, like with an old home video of them digging the foundation for the Great Northern.
Yep.
And then Hank comes in and Hank fires, you know, Ben's on his own. Mm-hmm. But you know what's cool about this scene is he mentions that he wants to rearrange the furniture in the office to create some kind of resonance, like the right resonance in his office is going to improve his consciousness, dude. Kind of mm-hmm. like the King's Chamber, right?
Definitely.
That's what like that was for.
Definitely like the King's Chamber. And also, I will note, if I may, that if you recall the Ashley Judd stuff in season three, that's what's happening, right? Ben is in his office and he and Ashley Judd are trying to identify the source of this beautiful ringing sound that they're hearing. That sounds like a Tibetan singing bowl. I think it actually is a Tibetan singing bowl. And sure enough, Ben is at peace in season three of Twin Peaks. It's as though a rearranging and a resonance has actually happened with him.
Dude.
And I think that's all intentional.
I was just thinking the King's Chamber.
Yeah. Well, the King's Chamber too.
Okay, so yeah, Wyndham Earl's making a chess move. Then there's the wedding.
You're right, by the way. That Ben scene is important. We'll get into it like in future episodes, but like this is kind of the turn where Ben really starts going downhill, and you know, Ben's in a really bad situation at this point. And this meeting that he has with Hank, where they get into it with each other, is kind of an opportunity for Ben to recap like how basically like he's just at the end of his rope. Nothing has worked out. All of his plans have gone to ruin.
Dude, it's going pretty bad when Hank's firing you.
Right. Exactly. Okay, and then the ending of the episode, again, doesn't wind up mattering, but like, you know, all these episodes end with something that's supposed to leave you hanging, and in this case it just so happens to be that we find out that Catherine's brother Andrew, the man who was married to Josie and who died all those years ago, leaving the mill to Josie, is actually alive. He has been alive this whole time. And Catherine has known about it, and they have some sort of long play in the works, where they're going to finally get their revenge on Thomas Eckard, because he's going to have to come looking for Josie, and that's when they'll pounce. So that's what's going on with that by the time we get to the end of this episode.
Do you notice how at the very end, Andrew looks at the camera a little bit, and then he turns his head to the sound of a door latch?
I didn't notice that.
Yeah.
What do you think that's about?
I don't know. It's like, why'd you look at the camera and then who's coming in the door? Or is that Josie leaving? But then why would he turn his head to it? I don't know.
I do not know.
Somebody's coming into the room right at the end of the... I mean, it's definitely a door latch sound.
Well, the only other person it seemed like it would be able to... that it would be Pete, but we know that it's not because Andrew is going to see Pete. You know, spoiler alert, but Andrew and Pete are going to reunite a little bit later on. And that's shown separately, so that's not it. I don't know. It probably doesn't matter. I mean, it definitely doesn't matter.
like some sound guy that's like going to the bathroom or something.
Yeah, it could be a flub. Yeah, totally. I don't know.
Yeah.
All right. That's Twin Peaks. Everyone let us know what you think about Twin Peaks or Killers of the Flower Moon. I mean, I'm sure people have thoughts about that. Like I said, it's actually a relatively timely movie. The Brazen
Does anybody
podcast
out there like it, and what are we missing?
I mean, right? Yeah. I mean, I do like it. That's weird. I guess I didn't sound like I liked it. I did like it. It was fine. It was worth watching and all that stuff. I just think that I was expecting something more, and I certainly wouldn't put it in with his masterpieces, which is what some people seem to think that it is. And I think people get fooled by things being really long. I think people get fooled by things being very, like, like you were saying, kind of like politically salient, like telling a story about, you know, the oppression of Native Americans is like obviously has a lot of cachet, the same way, like you said, an environmentalism movie would have. And I just think that if you try to step away from that and just judge it as a movie compared to his other movies, it's clearly flawed in a lot of ways, even if it's good. It is good, but just not great.
Yeah. Dude, if I would have made a flower, that's a flower, a story of that movie, of that book, excuse me. Mm-hmm. I mean, it would have been a lot worse. That's for sure.
There's a lot of cool ways to do it. I mean, I never even mentioned him, but the character of Henry was super interesting. You know, like Henry, if you go back and watch it again, that's the drunk guy, you know, who winds up getting killed. At the very beginning of the movie, he picks up Leonardo at the train station. And when they're driving on to King Hale's ranch, he says that that's his land, which, again, isn't really dealt with that much later on in the movie. But that's part of the reason why he had to be killed. And he actually owns all of that land. And he's a super interesting guy. Just the little glimpses that you get. And he was also very well acted. That's just one of the many different things that you could have done with that story that just felt like a little bit of a waste. But anyway, enough about that.
Yeah, I should have told it from their perspective. I mean, truly, they're the main characters. It revolves around them. I mean, anyway. All right. Yep. Well, yeah, let us know what you think. Good talking with you.
All right. Late.